This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of April 9th, here are a few top stories. In the news, on Thursday, just one day after educators and their communities rallied for more money, Arizona's governor has proposed a substantial pay raise for teachers. From KJZZ's education desk, Mariana Dale reports.
Governor Doug Ducey's staff arranged a backdrop of education leaders and lawmakers before he made the big announcement.
Well, it's a good day for teachers in Arizona.
Ducey proposed a 9% pay raise this year, leading to a 20% increase by 2020. The governor, who earlier called the Red for Ed movement a political circus, praised teachers.
I've been listening, and I've been impressed.
Ducey says these raises do not subtract from a previously promised $100 million for other school resources. The governor will have to work with the legislature to make the plan happen, and that means rolling back other proposals in the budget he originally wanted. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From the KJZZ original production, The Show, here's Mark Brody.
When a federal judge found former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio guilty of criminal contempt of court last year, the reason was that Arpaio allowed his deputies to continue making immigration arrests after a judge said he had to stop them. Before Arpaio was sentenced, though, he was pardoned by President Trump. For the immigrants who are unlawfully detained by MCSO, they have until the end of the year to apply for restitution for that. The county has set up a fund to find and compensate victims. Jude Joffe Block is the co-author of a piece about this and spoke with one of the victims. It was published today by the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. Jude joins me now. And Jude, let's first talk about the person with whom you spoke. What was his experience after he was detained in what turned out to be an unlawful traffic stop?
Yeah, this individual we call in the story Samuel was driving, didn't think they had done anything wrong. It turned out the motive for the traffic stop was a license plate light bulb that was apparently out. And then the stop spiraled into him ending up in handcuffs, just being a passenger in the car. The deputy's only motivation was apparently that, you know, he couldn't find Samuel in the system after he showed his Mexican passport. And clearly the deputy thought he was undocumented, tried to turn him over to ICE. ICE refused. And Samuel ended up being driven to a Border Patrol station. And then that turned into 8 days in the Eloy Detention Center, where he was detained before he was finally released when his family raised money for a bond.
Is there a sense of how similar or dissimilar Samuel's experience was to other people who were also stopped in some of these traffic stops?
So right now, the sheriff's office has identified from their records 189 people who were in this category of immigrants who didn't do anything criminally wrong but were turned over for deportation. And of those, some of them were sort of random traffic stops, like what happened to Samuel. A lot of them were, at the time, the sheriff's office was enforcing the Arizona human smuggling law. And sometimes if they didn't have enough evidence to make a criminal arrest, they would just turn individuals that they suspected were recent border crossers over to immigration officials. So some of those were in that category. Some were found walking. Some were pedestrians walking in the desert, suspected border crossers.
Now, Samuel is one of, as you said, a number of people who the county sheriff's office has identified. Do we really know how many people are potentially eligible for restitution that the court has ordered the office to set up for some of these folks?
We don't know what the entire universe is. 189 have been identified by sheriff's records, but immigrant advocates say that number could very well be incomplete.
Is the sheriff's office finding that victims are willing to come forward, are wanting to come forward to sort of apply for this restitution?
Well, so it's a third party that the county has contracted. It's a firm called Brown Greer on the East Coast that specializes in these claims programs. And so it's their job. They have a budget to advertise and also a budget to go and find people and try to notify them about this compensation program. So there's that list of 189 known victims. So far, they informed us that they've only been able to contact 4 of those 189
That's
known
not that
victims.
Many.
It's not that many because, I mean, these stops happened between 2011 and 2013. That was a long time ago. And it's mostly a population that's transient. So tracking these people down is incredibly difficult and getting the word out to them is hard. And then for those who are still in the Phoenix area, you know, there's a lot of fear in the community.
So Jude, let's talk about how this fits into the overall story of former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, his contempt of court ruling and the case involving that. How do these stops and now the attempt to find some of the victims to, you know, repay them, how does that fit into the overall story?
You know, over the years, since Arpaio first got serious about immigration enforcement in 2005, 2006, in that era, since then, there were thousands of people whose lives were impacted by the sheriff's immigration enforcement. A lot of the tools that the sheriff's department used for local immigration enforcement were later struck down by the courts. So at this moment in time, only a very small sliver of people whose lives were impacted are eligible for some kind of compensation. Only those who were stopped in this window of time when the judge said it was not appropriate. But there are a wider universe of people who feel like they were victimized by Arpaio, but they're not eligible for compensation through this program unless they meet these very specific guidelines.
So let's go back to the person that you'd interviewed, Samuel, who was a victim of one of these stops. Did he tell you that he was planning on filling out the forms? Is he looking to get some financial restitution from all this?
What's really interesting about Samuel is he's a deeply religious man. He is a practicing Christian, very active in his church, and really doesn't believe in material possessions. And so he didn't seem to prioritize it. So he had at his house, when I spoke with him, he had picked up a compensation form at one of these clinics, and it's about 11 pages long. And he said, you know, it's a lot of pages, you know, we're pretty busy people. He's raising 3 young kids. And he said, you know what, like, hopefully we'll get to it. And, you know, I calculated that based on what happened to him, he's eligible for about $13,000. And I think to a lot of us, we would be very eager to try to get that. For him, in his case, he's pretty reliant that, you know, he believes in a divine justice. He believes in, you know, everybody will have their day of reckoning. And that's kind of what he clings on to most importantly. So it remains to be seen whether he'll get his paperwork in.
All right. That's Jude Joffe Block. She's a journalist based here in Phoenix and the co-author, along with Terry Green Sterling, of a piece with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. We'll post a link to that at theshow.kjzz.org. Jude, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the KJZZ Science Desk, maintaining the Salt River Project's pipes, ditches, and canals poses unique technical and workforce problems. KJZZ's Nicholas Gerbis explores how SRP plans to keep the water flowing by working with Arizona State University on some novel helpers.
Here at Arizona Falls, SRP has provided water and power for more than a century. Today, new challenges face the utility, including keeping more than 1,000 miles of open canals, ditches, and pipes clean and clear of debris.
It takes a lot of resources to dispatch individuals, their trucks, the sampling equipment to a remote location.
SRP scientist Mike Plu sees robots as one way to lessen that burden.
If it can be done in an autonomous way with robotics or UAVs or something, then it makes things a lot more efficient.
Beyond handling dirt and debris, SRP uses herbicides and 50,000 sterile Asian carp to curtail algae and sago pondweed in open canals. But narrow lateral pipes, often choked with invasive quagga mussels, pose a tougher challenge. Brian Moorhead is an SRP environmental scientist.
We can run a device through there that would go in and remove those, either scrape it off or crush the shell and move through that pipe, then that would be a real advantage for us at this point.
So, robot-wise, SRP needs both an Air Force and a Navy. ASU's Wenlong Zhang is working on the former, a quadcopter that will fly itself to assigned locations, observe, and await orders.
We can actually real-time stream the video back to their station. So if they say, oh, this is something we want to take a look, how about we collect this sample?
Sampling might involve an onboard syringe or, for larger objects, a lightweight flexible grasper designed by ASU soft roboticist Panayiotis Polyerinos.
Soft robotics is a new field of robotics that is focusing mostly on how can you use new types of materials that are softer, more squishy, more stretchable than traditional rigid components that we would use to make robots.
In place of costly, heavy, and rigid motors or gears, the grasper's fingers rely on their segmented shape and stiff or flexible areas to curl when inflated. Engineers call this mechanical programming of materials. Zhang's drone will hover itself down to the target and...
Right now, the soft graspers, they will just go over the object. They will just start closing and conforming their fingers around whatever object that might be.
Hard robotics requires exacting standards, clearly defined before a single part is cut. Soft robotics permit looser tolerances and let the user create as many parts as needed, cheaply.
It's really low cost. For the UEV, the materials cost probably like $400 or $500. And the soft grasper, I think in terms of material, because it's just made of silicon, probably like $5.
Soft robots also better mimic nature, so ASU's Dan Aukus uses them in the fins of his lab's robotic fish, which SRP hopes to use in its smaller lateral pipes.
Fish are very good at using their fins to generate relatively high thrust at relatively low amounts of power, and so we're trying to mimic that.
Cheap, flexible materials let Aukus's lab replace months of complex fluid dynamics calculations with rapidly built prototypes.
If you can make something quickly, throw it in the water, and get a sense of how it works, that's an end run around the slow development process that you see in a typical research project.
These projects are ambitious. They involve solving some of the most intricate problems in robotics: object recognition, autonomy, navigation, flight, machine learning, for a variety of environs and missions, using minimal energy and limited computing power.
So my goal is to work on those high-level autonomy algorithms that will allow the UEV to sort of work autonomously, fly autonomously, without too many human intervention.
Both teams share that vision, and both are considering how their bots might one day coordinate in swarms or schools or combinations of both to achieve larger goals.
That's where a lot of innovation can be found, is bringing things together that you wouldn't otherwise try to do.
Whether or not SRP funding continues to flow after contracts end this summer, there's little doubt these teams have contributed to the latest wave of robotics research, a rising tide that will lift all bots. Nicholas Gerbis, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From the Fronteras Desk, Mexican and American researchers are exploring ancient archaeological sites in Mexico near the Sonora-Arizona border. Their studies might bring more light not only to the region's past, but also to the present indigenous communities. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
The border has been an obstacle to unify archaeological studies from Sonora and Arizona. But researchers at Valle del Altar in Mexico want to integrate knowledge while learning more from a little-known period of the Trincheras culture. Randall McGuire is one of the leading archaeologists.
It's more what's between the beginning and the end.
McGuire explains their investigation focuses on the 8th and the 14th centuries. Their studies will help understand the consolidation of ancient settlements and perhaps solve another present-day issue.
That the border was drawn through the Tohono O'odham people.
According to McGuire, their findings could demonstrate the ancestral presence of the Tohono O'odham in Mexico, reasserting their rights as a local indigenous group. Rodrigo Cervantes, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
You're listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And finally, from the Business Desk, here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein.
President Trump's move to hike tariffs on steel and aluminum from China, along with the threat to raise duties on $50 billion of other Chinese goods, has led to the very real possibility of a trade war. Many observers on the right and left have criticized Trump's rhetoric, saying that no one wins in a trade war and that it'll cause American consumers a lot of pain. One exception is Arizona Republic columnist Bob Robb, a self-proclaimed ardent free trader. He thinks a trade war with China may be necessary, and he's with me to talk about it. Bob, there seem to be very real risks here for the U.S. economy. And that being said, do you think Trump's predecessors should have been willing to engage in a trade war with China?
The answer is no, because until recently, I think it was wrong to reach the conclusion that I've reached, which is that China is a lost cause. But given the consolidation of power that Chairman Xi has amassed, and what he intends to do with it, which is to make the Communist Party, once again, primary in all of Chinese life, including economics, and what that means for the non-development in China of more free trade, more democratic governance. It's only recently that I think that reasonable people have to abandon hope that that's ever going to happen. So in China, there is no such thing as a truly private business of any size. If there was some hope that China would be evolving, as other Asian tigers have, South Korea, Taiwan, both evolved into democracies and became rule-abiding international players. There's no hope for that in China under Xi. So I think to protect our system of economy, we need to create a barrier to importing the Chinese system, either through goods or, more importantly to me, through investment. I would simply prohibit any Chinese-owned business from owning a majority stake in any U.S. business.
People may not be ready for price hikes and things. Do you think that's a legitimate fear, that people, as we see that even as employment growth has been solid, wage growth hasn't been so great, and now if we see prices rise, how's that going to affect things?
There is no question that you will see those effects. And Trump is wrong when he says that a trade war is easily won just because we buy more stuff from the other guy than he buys from us. The material well-being in both countries would go down. Prices on consumer goods would go up. There would be a temporary disruption in the supply chain for American manufacturers that rely upon certain Chinese component parts, although in a relatively short period of time, I think that could be reoriented outside of China. But there's no question that it's going to come at a cost. And I think Trump's objective isn't the right objective, because it's clear that Trump believes in managed trade, where politicians get together and decide how much of each other's goods are going to be purchased. I am an ardent free trader. If hope in China hadn't been extinguished, I would be against doing anything to try to narrow the trade deficit with China. But managed trade, which she might be willing to do. I mean, the Trump administration asked the Chinese government to come up with $100 billion of reduction in the trade deficit. That's how Trump keeps score. To me, that's not the objective. The objective, given that hope is lost, is to protect our system of democratic capitalism against the invasion and the infection of the Chinese state capitalism, which at this point I don't think there's any hope will evolve into something better and more compatible with economic relationships between our two countries. I'm under no illusion that whatever we do, China will match. That will create some hardship, particularly in the agricultural sector. And if we were to engage in the in a trade war the way that I'm discussing it rather than the way Trump is conducting it, you probably ought to talk about some kind of transitional assistance to the losers, the big prominent losers. We're all going to be losers, but the big prominent losers like agriculture in this particular trade war.
Is this an approach that could actually elicit a positive outcome, even if there's short-term pain?
If so, I think that we will have missed the moment.
Okay.
It is entirely possible, as I said, that Xi will be willing to engage in managed trade with Trump and agree to buy more of X, Y, and Z to reduce the trade deficit, and Trump will declare victory and go home. In the meantime, you still have a state capitalistic system with no evidence of evolving, selling us goods, and worse, buying up our companies. So Trump has the wrong objective. Even if we reduce the trade deficit, at this point, I don't think there's hope to see the kind of evolution in China that would warrant long-term economic interaction.
Bob Robb, columnist for the Arizona Republic. Bob, good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Always good to be with you.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.